You know, it's not like the giants just disappeared on their own, and I don't think that David and the Israelites killed every single giant, and so there were going to be men who came for the purpose of destroying giants. And just like nowadays, we have bounty hunters and big game hunters and all these types, there were dangerous mofos out here hunting these giants. And I think that's so badass to think about. Like, there were actual badass mofos out here hunting these giants, and not just hunting them, honey. They were beheading them. They were taking parts of their body as spoil. They were putting them up on places of elevation so everybody could see that they were being, that the giants were being slaughtered. These giant headhunters were not to be trifled with.
Hello, citizen. This content creator discusses controversial topics. To properly engage in this content, an open mind is required. There's something very strange about this man. The words he says, the things he does. Is he perhaps a glitch in the system? Is he a rogue federal agent? Is he actually alive? And on the loose, can anyone even stop him? He is one of the internet's most mysterious men of mystery. He is a man who has seen his own death and lives life on the run, surviving out of spite and because he's not superstitious, but he is a little stitious.
There was an age when men did not yet hate the giants enough. That was before the children began vanishing in winter, before the grain carts went uphill full and came back empty, before whole villages learned to smother their fires at dusk and keep the doors barred, because a giant lord was crossing the valley, and anything seen, heard, or desired by him was as good as taken. The old tales say the giants brought order, and that much, it is true. They cut roads through the wilderness, raised walls against the flood, taught men where iron slept beneath the hills, and turned scattered tribes into kingdoms that could endure more than one hard season. For a little while, starving people mistook this for mercy. But the giants did not build those kingdoms for men to possess. They built them the way a butcher builds a cage. Their roads carried tribute. Their walls kept the weak and closed, and their towers watched the valleys like dark, omnipresent eyes. They took the first harvest and left the rest to scrape through winter on what remained. They took sons for labor, war, and quarry work until their backs split open under stone. They took daughters into the mountain halls, and many were never seen again except in rumor, in nightmare, or in the faces of strange, oversized children born seasons later. When a village resisted, the giants did not make examples of one or two. They broke the whole place apart. Roofs were torn away, wells were fouled, elders were crushed into the mud before their own doorways, children were eaten alive, whole bloodlines ended in a single night because some towering beast in bronze and hide had felt slighted. And still men endured it. They endured because they were afraid, because fear can dress itself up as gratitude when survival depends on obedience. Better, they told themselves, to live under the shadow of monsters than to die in the open wild. They had forgotten how to survive on their own without their giant counterparts. Better tribute than annihilation. They figured. Better to surrender sons and daughters and livestock and half the harvest than to watch the entire village vanish beneath gargantuan feet. So the people bowed and called it wisdom. And while their chains were hammered into custom, they forgot God. Then came the years that stripped the lie bare.
The winters grew longer, the fields failed, disease moved through the valleys like a curse, the rivers froze wrong, the lambing seasons thinned, smoke no longer rose from certain hamlets, and no one was foolish enough to go looking. Yet the giants, they still came down for their due. They came bigger with their hunger, fouler with their rage, and less willing than ever to hear excuses. If the grain was gone, they took cattle, and if the cattle were gone, they took the stores, and if nothing remained worth carrying, then they took flesh. And in those years, men watched mothers starve so the very young could eat, watched fathers beaten to death for trying to hide a sack of meal, watched children dragged screaming uphill into the dark, and understood at last what the prosperity of the giants had always meant. They had not raised mankind. They had fattened it. They had deceived it. And they had enslaved it. That was when the thought first entered human hearts. Not like a trumpet, but like a final breath clawing its way out of a crushed chest. If the giants were not killed, they would all be eaten in the end. So the war began, not because men were suddenly noble or righteous, and not because courage had banished fear, but because there was nothing left to bargain with, and God had a demand. No harvest left to surrender, no daughters left to hide, no future left to save by obedience. Humanity fought because waiting meant extinction, and because the God of all had shown himself and demanded a price. They fought because every season endured was another village emptied, another family line erased, another generation taught to kneel. And they did not fight like heroes from polished songs. They fought like desperate animals turning at last on the thing with its teeth in their throat. They dug pits in frozen roads and covered them with brush and snow. They burned bridges beneath giant columns crossing ravines. They poisoned wells, collapsed tunnels, rolled boulders onto sleeping camps, and crept through the dark with blackened blades to hamstring monsters too huge to kill cleanly. Smiths forged weapons in secret from iron once tithed to their masters. Quarrymen undermined giant keeps from below. Shepherd boys became scouts. Widows became poisoners. Priests blessed ambushes. Kings hid in ditches beside peasants and waited for the same moment to strike. There was glory in this fight. There was also terror, mud, and the gore of the family. The hard animal knowledge that if the blow failed, and the head was not removed, everyone you loved would pay for it. And in time, the giants began to fall. Not all at once, not cleanly. Some died thrashing in burning towers. Some plunged into sinkholes and vanished beneath their own shattered halls. Some were swarmed in marshes and dragged down by ropes, hooks, and blades wielded by men half mad with hunger and grief. And once the first few fell, something changed in the world. Humanity learned how to trick the giants. The spell of them cracked. Men who had thought them inevitable saw that even mountains can bleed. The old legends say that when the last great giant lord died, the people did not cheer or celebrate. They were too ruined for that, haunted by the memories. They stood among the broken stones, among the graves and the fields that had fed monsters longer than they had fed children, and they wept, not from triumph, but from the knowledge of how near the end they had been. Another generation, perhaps less, another winter or two, another round of tribute, and there might have been no one left to rise at all. That was the hour the age of men truly began. Not in splendor, but in exhaustion, in grief, and in the terrible relief of having killed the thing that would otherwise have finished killing them. The First Book of Enoch, Chapter 19 and 21. And Uriel said to me, "The spirits of the angels who were promiscuous with women will stand here, and they, assuming many forms, made men unclean, and will lead men astray, so that they sacrifice to demons as gods, and they will stand there until the great judgment day, on which they will be judged, so that an end will be made of them. And I, Enoch, alone saw the sight, the ends of everything, and no man has seen what I have seen. And I went round to a place where nothing was made, and I saw a terrible thing, neither the high heaven nor the firm ground, but a desert place, prepared and terrible. And there I saw seven stars of heaven, bound on it together, like great mountains, and burning like fire. And then I said, 'For what sin have they been bound, and why have they been thrown here?' And Uriel, one of the holy angels who was with me and led me, spoke to me and said, 'Enoch, about whom do you ask? About whom do you inquire, ask, and care? These are some of the stars which transgressed the command of the Lord Most High, and they have been bound here until 10,000 ages are completed, the number of days of their sin.' And from there I went to another place, more terrible than this, and I saw a terrible thing. There was a great fire there, which burned and blazed, and the place had a cleft reaching into the abyss, full of great pillars of fire, which were made to fall. Neither its extent nor its size could I see, nor could I see its source. Then I said, 'How terrible this place is, and how painful to look at.' Then Uriel, one of the holy angels who was with me, answered me. He answered me and said to me, 'Enoch, why do you have such fear and terror because of this terrible place, and before this pain?' And he said to me, 'This place is the prison of the angels, and there they will be held forever.'" There must have come a time that man realized it was about time to start killing off all of these giants that remained. And even though we haven't thrown off all of our evil overlords, thrown out all of our evil overlords, or rid ourselves of all of the darkness that we have come to adopt and love, for what it's worth, there was a time when we started killing the giants. Are they coming back around? It would appear so. It would appear that the demons are infiltrating through technology these days, and so we have a Nephilim of an entirely different kind, although I believe that we will see Nephilim in the flesh before Christ returns, and so I do believe that we will yet get our chance to witness these abominations, even though we should not want to. But regardless, David makes a splash around 1000 BC, roughly, in the southern Levant, specifically the Valley of Elah, in the borderland between Judah and Philistine territory. And the biblical narrative places the armies of Goliath and Saul, or, you know, this would be the battle that would inevitably spell Goliath's doom during he would be killed here by David. But this took place between Soko and Azekah. And modern archaeology identifies Gath with Tel Asafi, which is roughly halfway between Jerusalem and Ashkelon. And David is remembered first not as a conqueror, but also as a younger son moving between pasture and battlefield camp. And 1 Samuel preserves the essential outline. Essentially, he was the youngest son of Jesse of Bethlehem. He served as a shepherd. He was perhaps a bastard. And he traveled back and forth to Saul's camp carrying provisions to his brothers. He had all these brothers who were fighting in the war. But traditionally, he belongs to the hill country and to the economy of flocks, not the heavy spectacle of war. He is definitely not seen as some great warrior. Goliath, by contrast, appears in the tradition as a frontier champion of a very different world. He comes from Gath, one of the Philistine cities, and he is believed to be a descendant of the great giants, the ones that were first in the land. Obviously, Goliath is getting towards the end of the giant age, So he is smaller. Some people say 6'9" is it was roughly his height. But 1 Samuel makes him feel like some sort of walking siege engine. He is armored very, very intensely. He is loud. He is ritualized, and he's accustomed to public intimidation. He does not just fight. He challenges day after day. I believe it was 40 days until an army begins to organize itself around his threat. Okay? So in that sense, the giant's true weapon is not only the giant sword that he wields, but also what he can sort of cause to happen on the battlefield through intimidation. What sort of essence he brings, what sort of vibe he brings to the battlefield. He freezes the battlefield. Nobody wants to face him. Which, you know, I'm just going to say it. Nobody wants to face him. Surely there were men alive on the battlefields of this time who were 6 feet tall, right? And so this guy would not seem necessarily that much taller than everybody else. So there must have been something about him, something other about him perhaps, that caused him to be so fearsome in these situations, or in this situation, excuse me. But regardless, he continues to taunt Israel because he wants to break their spirit. He wants to break their soul. He knows that the Israelites have not struggled in the past overcoming forces of greater number, and his force is indeed of greater number in this situation. Regardless, he continues to taunt in hopes that Israel will send forth one of their champions so that he can eat them or kill them at a minimum. Probably eat them too, but at a minimum, kill them. So a sequence of events unfolds, and David arrives from Bethlehem with food for his brothers, and he just happens to be there when Goliath comes out to issue all of his threats and start his shit-talking up. And so David eventually gets to the point where he is down on the battlefield ready to fight Goliath, and everybody's making fun of him. He is not wearing any armor. He has just a sling, and before anybody can really tell what's going on, David strikes the giant in the forehead with a stone from his sling, a single stone, and he kills him, okay? And then David takes Goliath's sword, and he goes up to the corpse of the giant, and he beheads the giant, the cherry on top, or the cherry off the top, which however you prefer to think about it. It's very symbolic and very definitive. And then afterward, the Philistines break. The death of their champion triggers panic and pursuit. Goliath's arms are taken and placed in the sanctuary, and his sword remains attached to David's later career. A lot of people think that his sword was some kind of ancient technology, some sort of weapon that was not normal at all. But David is perhaps the most widely documented giant killer of all time. And after Saul and Jonathan were killed, 2 Samuel 21 says that the Philistines had yet war again with Israel. And David went down and his servants with him and fought against the Philistines. And David waxed faint. And Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant, this is, you know, another mention of giants in 2 Samuel 21. Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him and smote the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swear unto him, saying, "Thou shalt go no more out with us to battle, that thou quench not the light of Israel." And it came to pass that after this, that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai, the Hushathite, slew Saph, which was of the sons of the giant. And then there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of Jaroregam, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was yet a battle in Gath, where was a man of great stature that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 24 in number. And he also was born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimea, the brother of David, slew him. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. So David be out here killing giants left and right. It's no thing for these Israelites, and especially for David. They are easy to kill, it would seem. Although there was a point where Israel was like, David, bro, these battles are getting pretty intense. You are our king. You need to stay back and be king. Let us fight the wars for you. God is on our side as well. You are the chosen king. We will fight. You lead. There is another story of a famous giant killer, which you might not expect. It comes from the Greek heroic world, and it is the story of Heracles, or as the Romans would later call him, Hercules. And the earliest setting for this story is in Ovid's Metamorphoses, Book 9 in the late 1st century BC, and this takes place in Libya, somewhere in North Africa in the Greek imagination. And Hercules, or Heracles, belongs to a category of figure that Greek tradition treated as older than ordinary kings, but still close enough to the human world to be useful for storytelling and warnings and moral and political memory. The Encyclopedia Britannica calls him one of the most famous Greco-Roman legendary heroes, and of course he is. We talk about him a lot in storytelling and legends and lore. Hercules, I mean, this guy is very famous. And do you ever ask yourself why, perhaps? Well, maybe it's because he was a real thing. He actually existed, and just like the stories of David and all of these stories continue, so too do the stories of Hercules, perhaps because there is a bit of reality in there. Okay? But he was the son of Zeus and Alcmene. He was persecuted by Hera, and he was shaped by that strange combination of divine birth and being part human. He is remembered as a strong man who is never allowed a stable life, and every victory leads him onward somewhere rather than home. Antaeus stands on the opposite side of the Mediterranean map. He is a giant of Libya. He is a son of Poseidon and Gaia, who compels travelers to wrestle with him. And there's something almost territorial about the story, as if the giant were a local sovereign of some kind of ground rather than a king in any civilized sense. The giant was very anchored to this location. There was something about this location that the giant held dominion over rather than any empire or castle, okay? And he didn't levy any tolls or issue any laws or decrees, but he does force passage through his zone to become combat. And there are details preserved that whenever Antaeus touched the earth, his strength returned. He's not just large, he is a being that is continually renewed by the land that is beneath him. And perhaps this is sort of like just symbolic of how the Nephilim are nurtured by the land in the tale, or perhaps there is some ancient watcher magic to this. But the meeting between Antaeus and Hercules occurs because Heracles is in effect a professional crosser of forbidden ground. Remember, he is perpetually pushed onward. Heracles enters because that is what his whole cycle is kind of built around. He is a giant killer. He moves through spaces where ordinary movement has been shut down by monsters or curses or impossible natural laws. That is his thing. And the defeat is one of the sharpest examples in world legend of a hero discovering the hidden rule behind the giant's strength, behind the Nephilim's strength. And it's said that Heracles realizes the source of Antaeus's power, so he lifts him off the ground, he separates him from the earth, and then he crushes him to death in this state of levitation. And that is a legendary, mythical action, but it also reads as almost like this old strategic lesson. The giant was unbeatable only so long as everyone else kept throwing him back onto the thing that sustained him. And this story, we should be thought of as the earth that sustained the giant. And we continue to fight him by putting him different places on our body. And yet he is still there until a David comes along, until a Heracles comes along. After Heracles defeats the giant, he does not found any dynasty in Libya or carry home any relics the way that David carries back the sword. He moves on, and that's pretty consistent with his border hopping broader cycle in Greek tradition, where single victories rarely produce the peace that is necessary for humanity to continue on in any sort of utopia. They prove that stature and purging the danger and pushing the hero into the next labor is kind of the inevitable cycle of these types of people, which is pretty legendary when you think about it. And so that's where we place that. We place it in legend, we place it in lore, we give it things that it is supposed to represent instead of tell it as the story that really was. It's possible to me that it really, really was, and that Heracles and Hercules, these were actual strong men who fought giants in the ancient past. You know, it's not like the giants just disappeared on their own, and I don't think that David and the Israelites killed every single giant, and so there were going to be men who came for the purpose of destroying giants. And just like nowadays, we have bounty hunters and big game hunters and all these types, there were dangerous, dangerous mofos out here hunting these giants. And I think that's so badass to think about. Like, there were actual badass mofos out here hunting these giants, and not just hunting them, honey. They were beheading them. They were taking parts of their body as spoil. They were putting them up on places of elevation so everybody could see that they were being, that the giants were being slaughtered. These giant headhunters were not to be trifled with. And I think among their ranks included people like David, included people like Heracles, like Hercules, and many others. These people, even if they weren't good people all the time, because that is one of the most insane aspects of the Bible, the biblical story to me, and not just the Bible, but also these legends and these lores, especially from Greek and Roman times, the heroes are not always good. Like, have you noticed that the heroes are not always good people? They're not always good. Sometimes they're hybrids. Sometimes they're not even 100% human. And yet they're still used by God. David was not, he was a great man, but not necessarily a good man. This dude murdered so he could bang bitches. Like, this dude was hardcore when it came to women. He actually had a thing for women. He had a weakness for women. And he was, he killed people because of that weakness. He did other things as well. I'm not going to go down the list of David's failures because David is a legend. But Hercules as well, Heracles, not a perfect being. It's yet to be seen if things that cannot be redeemed, if the creation of the Nephilim and the creation of the Watchers turned against them at one point and began waging war with them, if they were not always on the same page, and sometimes the offspring of these Watchers, you know, these other giants, perhaps these hybrids, whatever they may be, they chose to fight with man so that they could defeat these giants that were eating and destroying everything. It's really cool how God appears to use beings that you would normally, or people that you would normally not maybe look at and say, wow, that guy's a Christ-like figure. Normally, maybe you wouldn't look at them like that, but they're out here destroying the offspring of the angels, of the Watchers, who have been plaguing humanity, because it is the thing that must be done. It's the thing that must be done. And God favored David, which I think is really, really cool, because it shows that God values faith. God values the faith that you put in him over his being distracted by the sins you commit. Really cool stuff. Anyway, I digress. Hercules went on to kill many other giants. We don't really know the total number of giants that he killed specifically, but the total number of giants in this war that he was a part of was 24. And he played a pretty crucial role alongside the Olympian gods, particularly by killing giants who were destined to be defeated by a mortal and were obviously destined to be defeated by the decree of God, okay? By the will of God, they were destined to die. So you've got Alcyoneus, who is the strongest giant whom Heracles dragged outside his homeland to kill. You have Porphyrion, the leader of the giants, who was killed by Heracles and Zeus together. You have Antaeus, who we've been talking about, a giant whom Heracles killed by holding him in the air and crushing him with his strong arms. Then you've got Leon and Pelorius, mentioned as giants that Heracles defeated on his own in combat. You've also got Ephialtes, whom Heracles shot in the eye while Apollo shot the other eye. Insane battles are going on to defeat these giants. And if you strip away all of the simplifications and all of that, Heracles' real role in this giant story is bigger, pardon the pun, than just he killed X, Y, and Z. In the Apollodorus, the war cannot be won without Heracles. Just like in the biblical story, it cannot be told without David. When it comes to Heracles, after the named giant deaths are listed, the account ends by saying that Zeus smashed the rest with thunderbolts and Heracles shot them as they were dying. In other words, Heracles don't give an F about these giants, and he is here to fully function as the mortal seal on divine destruction. And that's also why later Greek art so often places Heracles near Zeus and Athena. He's not just present because he's popular, he stands beside the central Olympian powers because the myth needs him there, the story demands him there, and through him somehow I believe God's story is being told, therefore he remains essentially using the Nephilim image against them because Hercules was not 100% man, according to their stories. So essentially using their image against them, saying, through yourselves I will destroy you. But all this is why the giant stories are so prominent in places like Sicily and Etna and Nisiros and all those other volcanic lands in Italy. And it's the same in Iceland. Giants are often placed side by side with the weird volcanic activity, the destructive volcanoes that are plaguing that place as well. In the old world, you know, it wasn't as simple as it is now for stories to travel. You couldn't just tell a story to some magic box and then the next thing you know it's spread the whole world over and now you can't get the story untold. It took a lot longer for stories to travel, a lot of time, and often also it went through various different retellings during that time. It passed from mouth to ear, and it evolved as more and more mouths told the stories. But regardless, it is almost impossible that all of the stories of giants originated from one source and then simply spread and were adopted by other cultures throughout history. It's far more realistic to say that each culture experienced, in my opinion, largely on its own giants. I don't think that every story about giants is an elaborate retelling of the biblical story as it went down. I think a lot of these, what would appear as retellings of stories involving giants, are stories that each culture had on their own. They're many of them anyway. They're the stories that have been passed down through the generations by these cultures that experienced them. And it's yet to be determined in my mind, because it's something that I've been thinking about lately, if all of these myths, all of these legends, all of these different religions, these different Bibles, and all of this, even though a lot of them involve pagan gods, it is very fascinating to me how they all point to the Bible in the end. They all reflect the Bible. And so in a way, that makes even these evil pagan texts, we say evil, but even these pagan texts, these different texts, these texts that were meant to glorify other gods perhaps, as long as they don't contradict God, they seem to glorify him in a weird way. And parts of them will contradict and parts of them won't. And the parts that won't are the parts that you want to really consume and use to sharpen your understanding of God, the way he works and the way the world works while he's working on it. How the world looks, I should say, while God is working on it. What this construction zone is like, this battlefield, I guess we should call it, is like while God is waging war upon it. So I think that perhaps it's not too far-fetched to say that all of these religions that are in the earth, God is still using to pull mankind to him in a strange way. Okay, most of the major Greek myths that were written down come from the time of Homer, which is maybe 1200 to 800 BC. The ancient Greek mythographers were literally about 3200 to 2600 years ago, which puts them within our timeline, a timeline that we as believers in Christ can accept. It's pretty interesting stuff when you really think about it, because it makes you see the world as being filled with less evil and more like it's trying. You know, it's trying, but it's being deceived. It's trying to believe. It wants to believe. The whole world and everything in it is crying out for its creator to redeem it. It literally is. But if you can't see it that way, because there's too many giants in the way, you're going to see nothing but chaos and evil and violence. Interesting stuff. When we start talking about all these legends and all these stories and how they're not necessarily connected, they're all just stories that, you know, have been translated and retranslated and transported across the planet and spread from corner to corner and they're all the same stories just retold in different cultures and different religions. That's actually just not always true. Sometimes it's true, but it's not always true. For instance, two of the major belief sets when it comes to giants are the ancient Norse with Asatru, and then also the Greeks and the Romans, right? The Greco-Roman religion, the belief set. These two things, a lot of people say, well, they you know, obviously the Vikings and they and all that, they got their gods from the Greeks and the Romans. But the thing is, the language of the Old Norse did not split away from North Germanic until perhaps 700 AD, about 1300 years ago. So even though it's possible that some Greeks could theoretically have encountered Proto-Germanic tribes after 200 BC sometime, and those tribes could theoretically have had some older sort of ancestral form of the stories that they transmitted orally from generation to generation, you would have to think about those as pre-Norse myths. And unfortunately, the Greeks don't really have any record of meeting these people, which leads me to believe that the Norse also, their beliefs came from something as well, other than just somebody else telling them what their story is. And they have a story too, which you guys will probably recognize, the story of Beowulf and Grendel. But it deals with events of the early 6th century and takes place in what is now known as Denmark and Sweden. Oxford's Great Writers and Spires places the defeat of Grendel by Beowulf in the Germanic Heroic Age, roughly the 4th to 6th centuries sometime. And the poem was probably written sometime between 700 and 750. Beowulf is another one of those mysterious figures in legend and lore. It's easier to place him in time than most giant slayer traditions, but that's not because the hero himself is historically secure in any way. It has been said that there's literally no evidence for a historical Beowulf, even while some of the named kings and places in the story appear to really be real places in medieval memory. But again, we think about Heracles, we think about Hercules, we think about some of these legendary giant slayers who were quote unquote not real. People could even say that, you know, David was not real. If they really wanted to, they'd be idiots to say it, but they really could. But that doesn't mean anything to me, because somebody says something is not real, somebody who has never seen anything ever even remotely close to the time period that this historical figure lies in, cannot tell me that they know definitively what happened in that time. So regardless, I think of Beowulf as, even though maybe him himself is not a real figure, what he represents is a real figure and perhaps even a real entity. Beowulf enters as a warrior from what is now southern Sweden, and he's not yet an old king in this part of the poem, but a young man who is seeking renown by answering another ruler's crisis. That ruler is Hrothgar of the Danes, whose great hall has become unusable because of, you guessed it, a giant, Grendel. For 12 years, the hall has suffered under a man-shaped, man-eating being who comes by night and turns a place of order into a slaughterhouse. Very familiar description of what we know giants to do. Grendel is where the nearly historical tone, however, has to keep one foot in the dark, because he is not a giant in the plain biblical sense, but he does belong to the same family of memory, if you will. He's this oversized, antisocial entity linked to some kind of old bloodline and a curse. The Oxford Summary also notes that the Christian poet casts him as a descendant of Cain, which is important. The monster is not just physically dangerous, he's morally displaced, and he's an outcast. Like, I would imagine a lot of any of the surviving giants in the sort of like towards the end of their time would be. The ones that are cowering in caves, the ones that are retreating to the hills, the ones that are just trying not to be killed by the multitudes of humans that now outnumber them, and maybe even some of their own kind. There's going to be giants who are outcast, and they are banished, and they are told to GTFO, and then they do GTFO. So that's the kind of sense that we, that's the kind of verbiage that we interpret Grendel with, okay? And when Beowulf meets Grendel, he deliberately goes to the site of defilement and waits. And he does not track Grendel through the wilderness. He sleeps in the hall that has been made uninhabitable, and he forces the creature to come back to the scene of its own habitual dominance. Grendel then enters at night. There is a violent hand-to-hand struggle, and Beowulf tears off the monster's arm at the socket. And then what happens after is also important. The Danes experience immediate relief by the destruction of this Nephilim, but it only lasts until the next night when Grendel's mother strikes back. And now we're starting to see a detail that gives the tradition of giant fighting an almost feud-like realism. These giants enact revenge for one another. One killing produces another. If you read the poem, Beowulf later presents Grendel's head and hilt, which was taken from this hall, which is underwater, by the way, to Hrothgar. But the more lasting aftermath that he experiences is fame. He returns to Gateland with a reputation that has been enlarged by this foreign operation, and he eventually becomes king. Yet another very interesting story of a giant slayer that becomes king, or a legendary figure that is out here killing the giants, because the giants must be killed, because the people that are beneath the giants are quite literally suffering beyond belief. And this is another interesting story, because it's one of those stories that takes a myth and puts it directly into a real historically accurate timeline. It's really, really interesting when myth and fable do that, when legends and lore do that, when they are allegedly nothing but myths and fables and stories from a time, stories that are not real, mythical Lord of the Rings style stories, and yet they're placed within a real actual timeline beside real actual places and real actual kings. So Rustam comes to us through one of the strongest literary channels in the whole Giant Slayer archive. Ironica notes that the Shahnameh stands as Iran's national epic, and that Ferdowsi completed it in 1010 BC, or AD, excuse me, from older materials. In this story of Rustam and the White Div is more than just another brutal enemy from stories. Ironica's entry on Div makes clear that demons in Iranian tradition are literally shape-shifting, magical, and often military, which makes a lot of sense, considering that Azazel pretty quickly gave everybody the power to fight, to make weapons and fight wars and stuff. So in this specific cycle, the White Demon, or White Div, blinds Kaivus and his host through sorcery. And the giant, or the demon here, doesn't just eat their bodies, but he completely bamboozles them altogether. He puts a king and an army into literal darkness, and that is why the story is so incredible. The adversary is not only massive, but he is also somehow a magician. He is a corrupter of sight, of judgment and order. He can cause chaos through some sort of magical powers. Rustam, the hero, reaches him by way of the Haft Khan, the Seven Labors. The last encounter is taking place in a dark cave after Rustam has already completed these six other dangerous feats. The defeat in the story is quite savage. It says that the battle in the cave was terrible, and Rustam, in some versions, cuts off the White Div's leg during the combat. Other summaries describe him as taking the demon's heart blood, or his liver blood, afterwards. And he definitely, at one point, beheads the giant and wears his head. Rustam restores Kaivu's sight by bathing his eyes in the Div's blood, which is pretty interesting because the giant is not just killed. His body literally becomes the cure for the blindness that he caused, which leads to all sorts of other questions that I just don't have time to get into today. What happens after is what you would expect of when an area is sort of rid of its Nephilim influence. Ironica says that physical and moral sight are restored, and Kaivus responds with a better, more harmonious kingship. There's more consultation and feasting. Our hero had descended into this place of darkness, right? He had killed the demon, or the giant that was there, this monstrous chief who had ruined all of their perception. And then he literally returned with the means to heal the court. And again, it's another one of those stories that can't necessarily be placed literally and historically, but most likely does represent something very real. Represents something that actually happened in some capacity. It seems like a lot of these stories signify, if nothing else, a definitive end to the age of giants. In the old British legend, the island was not empty when Brutus of Troy arrived. It was said to be haunted by the last remnants of some older race, a brood of giants who belonged to the land before kings, before cities, or before history even. And their greatest among them was Gog Magog. I'm sure you guys have heard of this. He was a monstrous figure who is remembered as standing 12 feet tall. He was a brute of raw, ancient strength, more like a piece of the island that had been torn loose and came alive somehow than any ordinary man. Brutus, the exiled Trojan hero who was later said to have founded Britain, came ashore with his followers to claim the land and begin something new. But the island did not just accept him. according to the legends. The giants attacked, and what followed was a deliberate purge, because Brutus and his men fought them brutally. Brutus bequeathed upon these big bitches brutality, okay? He destroyed them ruthlessly. He cut them down. He mowed them down, and he went through their entire race until only one remained, and that was Gog Magog, the fiercest and most terrible of them all. And he was the final obstacle, the last living sign that Britain ever belonged to something older. And at that point, one of Brutus's mightiest companions, Corineus, came forward. He was a warrior, extremely strong, and so proud that he refused to let the giants simply be hacked down with the others. He wanted the honor of meeting Gog Magog body to body, so the two were matched in a wrestling contest. And according to the story, Gog Magog nearly crushed Corineus on a number of occasions, and some tellings he even broke his ribs in the struggle, but this was a violent strength against an even more violent strength. This was a resolved man against a giant. This was symbolic of civilization coming against the raw old gods of the world, okay? And so Corineus endured. He grappled him. He mastered the weight of the giant, and he forced him backward toward the cliff's edge upon which they were fighting atop. And then Corineus heaved Gog Magog up and hurled him from the heights onto the rocks below. And the giant's body was shattered against the coast, and with him died the last of Britain's giants. And the place where he fell was even remembered afterward as Gog Magog's Leap. It's always interesting when those sort of things remain in our memory, like when we call places Devil's Gate or Devil's Hill or whatever the heck we call it. But it's interesting how that kind of stuff also continues to happen, you know. But the deeper point of the story is not just that a giant was killed. It's that Britain, the legend, is founded through the destruction of what came before, which is a giant. Brutus doesn't just get a blank island. He didn't just show up somewhere and there was nothing here like they would have us happen with North America. He takes it from monstrous inhabitants, and Gog Magog becomes the last witness of that buried age. I sometimes wonder if it was a very similar situation in North America. I sometimes wonder how North America has gotten away with not having the giant stories that all these other places in the world have. Why did North America not have the same civilization, the same level of civilization, the same level of legend and lore as everywhere else? Perhaps there was a great battle that occurred here, much more recent in history. So recent, in fact, that the natives, their stories are kind of mixed up a little bit, and they remember the giants in much more recent history. We even write about the giants in the early 1900s when we first start digging this land up. All very interesting stuff. Thank you everybody for listening. We have a very cool episode coming up on Monday. A very, very cool episode coming up for you on Monday. Please make sure that you tune in on Monday, because we are going to have an absolutely fascinating guest that I know each and every single one of you is going to be excited to see. So, thank you all for listening. The life is in the blood.